I said about the task of looking at the book of James and entitled a series of messages, Can You See Him? And May and June are gone now. And next Sunday is the 4th of July. For those of you who are like me and tend to forget, you know, the summer's only June, July, and August, and June is gone this week. And next week, being 4th of July, is going to be an interesting Sunday. But so that our study's moving along. Today is June 27th, and we're going to look at a passage from James chapter 5, the first six verses. And it's entitled, The Warning to the Rich in the Christian Life. There are several things that I really don't relish the idea of talking about as a preacher. I'm not really fond of talking about hell. In my past experience, I've heard too many sermons where people try to scare the hell out of people, and I don't really relish that. Periods of time I will do it because I need to do that. And the other thing is talking about money. There's a lot of people who, if they showed up for church the first time and all the preacher was talking about is money, they're going to say, yeah, that's it. The only thing the church wants is my money. So I don't really relish doing that, but I will do what I'm called to do. So I'll confess to you right up front, I probably wouldn't have picked this, but who is James talking to? When we look at James chapter 5, he's writing this in the year 49, and so it's just a few years after the death of his big brother, Jesus, and he's writing it to the Jews in the church in that period of time. But as you read that passage, can we relate it to ourselves? Is it possible to take what he wrote in 49 and transpose that into 2010? Do we do this? Is there a pattern of this abuse in our day and age? If it's not relevant to us, then what's the point? But I think you'll see when we get done looking at these few verses in James that the problem they experienced in the year 49 is not significantly different from the struggles you and I have in 2010. So here's what it says in the Bible in James chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Look here, you rich people. Weep and groan with anguish because of the trouble, the terrible trouble ahead of you. Your wealth is rotting away. Your fine clothes are moth-eaten rags. Verse 3 says, Your gold and silver have become worthless. The very wealth you are counting on will eat your flesh like fire. This treasure you've accumulated will stand as evidence against you on the day of judgment. For listen, hear the cries of the field workers whom you've cheated out of their pay. The wages you've held back cry out against you. The cries of those who harvest your fields have reached the ears of the Lord of the armies of heaven. You've spent your years on earth in luxury, satisfying your every desire. You have fattened yourselves for the day of slaughter. You have condemned and killed innocent people who do not resist you. So this is the outline that I came up with from those scriptures. First of all, on the back of your bulletin, you'll find we want to look at the attitude of the rich. Second of all, we want to look at the deception of wealth. Thirdly, God hears prayers and then he acts upon what he hears. And fourthly, judgment is spoken. So as we think about can you see him, how much of our identity is wrapped up in wealth? When you think about the identity of who you are, how much of that is involved in your wealth? I think that if you're honest, there's a significant portion of how we define ourselves in relationship to wealth. Now, I look at it from a guy's perspective, actually, and so it's a little different from some of you girls, but guys use that as a scorecard to see how well they're doing in life. It's actually something that you can tally and you can verify your credibility and your worth because you're making so much money or because you have so much money or because of the different assets that you have. When Julie and I were on vacation a week ago, I literally was driving down a country road and found an old Corvette that had been stored in a barn for years. And I drove right by it, and then I told Julie, I said, we got a couple minutes. I'm on vacation. I'm going to turn around and go look at that. So I walked all the way around it. I looked under the hood, and I looked in the interior, and I took Julie to dinner. And on the way back, I came down the same road, and I said, I'm going to stop and look at that again. And quite honestly, I've had a real struggle over this week to get this 68 Corvette 427 four-speed T-top car out of my head. And part of it is the nostalgia or the romance of finding an old car sitting in a garage for years that's got literally mothballs laying on the floor and the potential of what it could be, right? But also part of it is the identity of, oh, I've got a first-generation 68 big black Corvette. It's the first year they put 427s in these things, and it's wrapped up in my guy's genes. And Jewel says, why do you want a sports car that has more horsepower than what you can legally use? I don't know, but I do. Now, you know, I read a cartoon on my computer the other day that says you are what you eat. And there was a squirrel laying on the psychiatrist's bench saying, I must be nuts. But our identity is wrapped up in what we eat, how we look, how much we have, what we drive, right? It is. Julie and I were on a walk the other day, and we walked past some people's houses. There's a man and a wife there, and they have two Mercury Marquis, two pickup trucks, and two economy cars. For the two of them, you know, and we're thinking, is identity in our culture like this? Walk past another neighbor's house who has a six-car garage, but his truck sits out all year because he has a fleet of old motorcycles. But in his life, his identity and is involved in his assets. Now, did I make my point that a lot of us are like that, aren't we? Wealth has an influence on who we are. Now, in James chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, it says, look here, you rich people, weep and groan with anguish because of the terrible troubles ahead of you, period. Your wealth is rotting away. Your fine clothes are moth-eaten rags. So, the attitude of the rich. Do I see myself as a rich person? How do I define what's rich and who's poor? Does the Bible have truth to tell me about what I believe? When you look at that, you know, as we prayed earlier for the people in the island of Haiti, if you and I were able to take the transporter off the side of me and have Scotty just beam us to the island of Haiti right now. Remember in Star Trek when, beam me up, Scotty. If we were able to just push the button here and said, beam us to Haiti, Gotti. If we landed in Port-au-Prince this Sunday morning and spent the day walking through the displaced people's homes, I think you would change the way you believe about who's rich and who's poor. Eric Carlson and I were sitting in a hut in Africa, and the leader of this tribal village says, I would like to go to America. Why do you want to go to America? Because there are no poor. Eric and I tried to justify ourselves. Well, we have poor. No. No, you do not have poor. You do not have poor in your country. Here we have poor. And Eric and I, you know, tried to justify that, well, you know, there's certain parts of our country where there, he says, no, let me show you. Let me show you. You know, my parents used to have a saying that they were too poor to have a pot to pee in or a window to throw it out of. You know, they used to say that at times when we were going through Eva's records and we were looking at Eva and Howard's wedding. They took what money they had and paid the justice of a peace to marry them. Then they went to a church chicken and noodle potluck for their wedding dinner and celebration post-wedding. And then they went to family's home and slept on the couch for their honeymoon. And they had no money left after they paid the justice of the peace. And were happy and content and thought they were on top of the world because they had love and they had each other. And as Julie and I read through that, we thought, how many young people today would consider themselves to be happy and content with two people at the justice of the peace and going to a potluck at church for their reception? Think about it. Now, does the African Haiti and the marriage illustration begin to shape a picture for you of who's rich? So can you see him? How many times did Jesus' older brother talk about this thing of rich and poor? Who did he say was blessed? The rich or the poor? The poor. Blessed are you who are poor in spirit. Blessed are you who are poor in... It's not us rich people who are the blessed ones in the kingdom's sake. It's the ones who are intimately dependent on the provision of the living God who are the blessed ones. The sparrows. Those are the blessed ones, not us fat, rich people. Now, can you see him? What did he say was the best thing you could do with your wealth? When Jesus was talking, what did he say was the best thing you could do with your wealth? Develop your 401ks, have your savings. You need at least one speedboat and one fishing boat because you don't want to get that stinky cheese bait on your nice ski boat. And you need vehicles and you need, right? No. It's not what he said. You know, there's really only two places in the Bible where people are guaranteed their salvation, and one of them is Zacchaeus, and it had all to do with money. He climbed up the sycamore tree like we got outside. Jesus walked by, and he says, Zacchaeus, come down. I'm going to your house today. And at this meal, Zacchaeus says, I'm giving away half of all that I have to the poor. And if I cheated anybody, I'll pay him four times as much as I cheated him and make it all right. Jesus said, salvation has come to this house today. See, it makes a significant difference what we do with our wealth as far as the kingdom goes. So, what have we read in the book in Acts about the church and the people and their wealth? As you were reading through Acts with me at the beginning of this week when I was developing this sermon, what were they doing with their assets? They were selling them, and they were bringing them and laying them at the apostles' feet. And we read the Ananias and Sapphira deal where they sold their property and they thought they were going to be able to lie to God about keeping half of it back. And Peter says, hey, you could keep the whole thing. But because you tried to lie to God, to the Holy Spirit about this, you aren't going to spend that half. And Ananias died. A few hours later, the woman got done with her work. She came by and Peter says, you know, what did you sell your property for? And she lied. She said, why did you and your husband lie? The guys who buried your husband are here to bury you. And they died. Now, that's got to be one of the weirder stories in the Bible. But people were selling everything they had, giving it to the church, and they were living together where they met day by day, every day, studying the scriptures and praying together. Their wealth was distributed among the church. So, what is it God is asking you and I to do with what He's given us? What is He asking you and I to do with the wealth that we have? I don't know what He's asking you to do with it, but it's a pretty good guess that He's not going to let you continue in sin without repercussions. Now, can you see Him? How's that working out for you? How well are you doing at being obedient to what God says to do with the wealth that He's given you? How are you investing that? Has James made it clear that we cannot love God and money and pleasure are evil? You can't love both of them. And that friendship with the world is hatred towards God. As James made that clear to us so far in our study, you can't live the way the world tells you to, be friends with that financially, and be friends with God. If you're listening to Edward Jones rather than James and Jesus, you're on the wrong track. And I could have used any financial investment portfolio group, you know, Fidelity or any of them. I did. That one just happened to pop in my head. But the ways of the world are going to be different. The trust of the world is going to be different than the ways of God and the trust of God. So has our culture made it clear that we can love money and debt? Is there anybody here that the culture we live in says you can love money and you can love debt? Have you noticed that that's the way it is? Did you read in the newspaper that our state owes the school district in our community almost $3 million? And do you realize that what our president has been doing over the first year of his term, my grandchildren are still going to be paying on that debt? You realize this, don't you? We're spending money that we don't have. That's what the world says you can do. What is the average unassetted debt of an American citizen on their credit cards? Not stuff they have tangible things they could sell and get the money for, but just unassetted. It's in the teens of thousands of dollars. Last time I looked was beginning of this year, like $17,000 is the average American unassetted credit card debt. And they think, well, I'm doing a lot better than the government. Right? Here's what it says in Matthew 6:24. No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. You can't do it. You can't serve God and money. Now, just this morning, I put that OC on there because Julie read me this devotion first thing this morning. And here's what it says in Oswald Chambers, My Utmost for His Highest. The overshadowing of God's personal deliverance. Jeremiah 1:8. I am with you to deliver you, says the Lord. Then OC's commentary is, God promised Jeremiah that he would deliver him personally. Your life shall be as a prize to you. In Jeremiah 39:18. That's all God promises his children. Do you get that? Your life. That's all God promises us. Wherever God sends us, he will guard our lives. Our personal property and possessions are to be a matter of indifference to us, and we should hold on to those things very loosely. If this is not the case, we will have panic, heartache, and distress. Having the proper outlook is evidence of the deeply rooted belief in the overshadowing of God's personal deliverance. So, I'm going to get back to that in a minute. But when Julie read that this morning, I said, that's really what God is saying. I will preserve your life eternally if you are related to me through my son Jesus. But all this stuff that you love, all this stuff that you hang on so tightly, trying to keep it, trying to maintain it, all that's, the love for that is a problem. Do we need more than food, clothing, and shelter? Do you really need any more than that? Now, you don't need a whole lot of clothing when it's this warm outside. For those of us who are sitting in air conditioning, you know, long sleeves and a jacket or a sweater are comfortable, but outside, you really wouldn't need a whole lot, would you? Now, in 1 Timothy 6:8, but if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Now, I've added shelter because it gets cold around here in the wintertime, and you do need shelter in the winter, not necessarily in the summer. But these are the things that we should be content with. So, who has had nothing to eat? I don't see any hands pop up. Who has nothing to wear? I saw some people running around this week that I thought they didn't have much to wear. But, and so did the people on the Florida beaches, yeah. None of us have the problem that we don't have clothes to wear. Julie and I actually loaded the van twice this week. Our a full van full of clothes that we took to the thrift shops. And Jesus is saying, if you got something to wear and you got a clean change to change into, you got more than enough. When Julie and I travel on the motorcycle and we just have a couple outfits, you wear one and then you wash the other, and then when the one you're wearing gets dirty, you put that on, then you wash the other one. You know, it's a very freeing way to live. What am I going to wear? What's clean? It's not you're standing in your closet. Oh my goodness, which one of the whole of this stuff? So, are we rich? Yes. Do I need to develop that anymore? We are rich. There's none of us here in this church that are poor. And if there's people out there listening to this on the World Wide Web, because you have a computer and you have the ability to pay for internet access, you too are rich. Right? So in James chapter 5, verse 3, your gold and your silver have become worthless. The very wealth you're counting on will eat away your flesh like fire. That's scary. This treasure you accumulated will stand as evidence against you on the day of judgment. Let me just read that one through that sentence a second time. Think about this. This treasure you have accumulated will stand as evidence against you in the day of judgment. There is going to be a day of judgment. They call it the white throne judgment oftentimes. But there will be a time in eternity when every individual will stand before God and be judged by what you did and didn't do. And a significant portion of that judgment will have to do with your wealth. So we looked at the attitude. Now there's a deception of wealth. Is James trying to expose a great lie about wealth? What is it? And have you and I bought into it like most of the people in the world around us? Now, think about this for a minute. Did the Bible work on a gold and a silver standard? In Bible times, did they have paper money? Have banknotes? No. It worked on a gold and silver system. Who here can remember when our country worked on a gold standard? Any of you alive at the end of World War II? Some of us were serving in the Army when Mr. Nixon in 1972 did away with the ability to exchange a dollar for gold. That happened in my lifetime. How many of you can remember the silver standard? I was talking to my brother-in-law the other day, and he said, you know, when I was younger and my brother was living out in Nevada, we'd drive out there, and once you'd get into Nevada and you stopped to fill up your car with gas, you could fill your whole car with gas for $4. And when you gave the attendant in the gas station your $20 bill, he would give you 16 silver dollars back and say, some of that cheap Eastern money. But in Nevada and in Arizona, it was real money. It was silver dollars. It was a real deal. And for a period of time, our country lived on the silver standard that you could take a paper dollar and go in and get an equivalent ounce of silver worth $1. We have lived long enough that you could go in and get a dollar's worth of gold. Now, when did we leave the gold standard and the silver standard? In our lifetime. In our lifetime. They did away with it a little bit during the Civil War because of great debt. They did away with it after World War II for a while because of a problem with that. But what happened is we now, on a global basis, live on what they call a flat money rate. It's flat money. They can make as much of it as they want, and there's no assets backing it up. I can read where Mr. Truman, for a period of time, said, you can't possess gold as an individual because the crisis was great in the economy. So he just said, you can't do that. Most of us don't live with the reality that there's nothing backing up the money that we have. If you're going to save, it's probably a good idea to save in something that is tangible, like gold or silver. Now, you're never going to be able to take a gold coin into Walmart and pay for your groceries. But historically, gold maintains a basic value because there's a limited amount of it. And in your investment portfolio, if you're going to have investments, it's probably a good biblical idea to have some gold and to have some silver. Because when the paper isn't any good anymore, that'll still be worth something. Now, can you see him? Is James saying that it's possible that the money as we know it could become useless? It could really become useless. In our generation, in our lifetime, the whole balloon could pop and the whole thing could fall apart. Because it's just like when you used to go on vacation and you sit around on boring rainy days and build a house of cards. Any of you ever do that? And you'd get so far up and you'd realize on that level there, I wished I would have put that card different. And you can see as you go up that eventually that's going to cause a problem and the whole pyramid of cards is going to collapse. Anybody ever do that? On a humid day on vacation, you couldn't be outside because it was rainy and stormy. And that's our financial system globally. It's just a house of cards. There's nothing of value behind it. Now, what does James mean by that? The very wealth you're counting on will eat away your flesh like fire. This treasure you've accumulated will stand as evidence against you on the day of judgment. What does that mean? Is James saying that the treasures on earth will only rot and fade away? So we should be storing up eternal treasures in heaven? That's what you think he's saying. So how's that working out for you? How well are you doing at accumulating treasures in heaven? I'm not going to ask you how well your 401k is doing, how well your stash in the bank is doing, how well your assets are developing that you got in the stock market. How well are you doing at eternal treasures? In Matthew 6:19, Jesus says, look at those first two words. Do not store up for yourselves treasure on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Don't do that. But store up for yourselves treasure in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. How well are you doing at that? How well are you doing at storing up treasures in heaven rather than on earth? Does the Bible have truths to tell us about these beliefs? There's a cute quote in the end of Oswald Chambers that I thought about reading you, but because it's 10:45, I'm not going to. James 5:4. For listen, hear the cries of the field workers who have you cheated out of pay. The wages you have held back cry against you. The cries of those who harvest your field have reached the ears of the Lord of the armies of heaven. So, we talked about the attitude of the rich, the deception of the wealth. Now, God hears and acts. Does this passage tell us, what does this passage in James tell us? Is it saying, how do you take advantage of people? If we spend our money on things that we know are made in sweatshops overseas, are we promoting the mistreatment of people? If you're buying stuff that you know by the price of it, it was not made here, and it's so cheap that somebody in some place on the earth was paid very little to produce that. When you promote an economy like that by buying the cheap stuff, as having a conversation with somebody about the cheap tool store, I've never been there. One of the reasons I don't go there is because I'd spend money. But one of the reasons I don't want to go there and spend money because they sell it for a third of or a quarter of what it costs to make it in the United States. I know that some poor little man or woman or child in some sweatshop made that. You couldn't pay anybody a decent wage and sell it for that amount of money. Now, it's not that I'm just always going to buy quality stuff. It means I'm doing what James says not to do. If you buy that cheap stuff, you know, if you buy into the mentality, I'm going to this store that sells everything cheaper than everybody else, they're obviously not paying somebody very well to make it. So how are you investing? Oh, look at how much money I saved. Oh, look at how much money I saved by buying this cheap stuff that was made. I'm not just talking about American economy and American jobs. I'm talking about mistreating poor people when you support an economy like that. When the day of judgment comes around, God's going to have time in eternity to talk to you about each one of those shopping trips and how it affected human beings on earth in your lifetime. Save your money? Sure, go ahead. Can you see him? Is it clear to us that God hears the cries of the poor and the oppressed? He hears the poor people's cries. Is it clear that when God hears it, their cries, that information is disseminated down to the armies of heaven? Is that clear to you? He not only hears it, he dispatches the armies of the heavens. I had several army jokes that I was going to tell you, but I'm not going to do those right now. It's clear that God hears the prayers of the poor and acts. But it's not really clear that he hears the cries of the rich and dispatches the armies of heaven to make them richer and fatter and more prosperous. Now, if you want to hear that, there are churches in our culture, in our time, who preach prosperity. And there's millions of people in those churches and watching them on TV today. That's not what I think is biblically true. I'm not going to preach you healthy, wealthy, and wise. What I'm going to preach to you is what I believe the truth. If you've got food, clothing, and shelter, you got enough. Invest what you have after that in treasures in heaven. In James 5 and 6, have you spent your years on earth in luxury, satisfying your every desire? Have you fattened yourselves for the day of slaughter? Have you condemned and killed innocent people who did not resist you? So the outline concludes with judgment is spoken. Is there a law of judgment in God's system? See, there's a law of gravity. There's a law of judgment in God's system. How has God set it up? Who's exempt? Who is not going to function under the law of gravity? Anybody? Who is not going to function under the law of judgment? Anybody? Jesus is the only one. And he's going to be the one who executes it. So, the unchanging law of judgment is this. In Matthew 7:2, for the way you judge others, you'll be judged. The way you measure, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. That's the deal with money. The way you measure it out now is the way it'll be measured to you. This is not a haphazard theory. It's an eternal law of God. Now, do we believe the statements in the Bible are true? Do we believe the statements of the Bible? Many of us in our practical experience don't believe this law of judgment is actually true. Who wants to stand before God and say, okay, treat me just like I treated people when I was on earth? Anybody? That's the deal. That's the way it is. God will use the measure you use, the way you judge people, to judge you. You get to set the standard. So, let me try to summarize what James is saying. He's proclaiming the worthlessness of riches, not the worthlessness of the rich. If you're rich, leverage what you have to get treasures in heaven. There's not a problem with money, it's just when you love it more than him. Today's money will be worthless when Jesus returns. When Jesus comes back, doesn't matter how much money you have, it's not going to be worth anything. So, spend your time accumulating the kind of treasures that will be worthwhile in God's kingdom. Don't spend all your time working on your portfolio here. Build a portfolio in God's kingdom. See, money is not the problem. It's the love of the money that leads to evil. It's the trust in your money. It's your believing what the world says. You've got to be, you know, next week we'll celebrate Independence Day. And they say you've got to be financially independent. That's what the world says. God says, I don't want you to be financially independent. I want you to be God dependent. Ownership is the key. When you live with the reality, it's not my money, it's God's money. then you've got it right. It's God's money. I'm going to invest it in God's kingdom. Now, he doesn't have a problem if you have food to eat, clothes to wear, and shelter to live in. But when you love that stuff and trust that stuff more than him, it's a problem. So we live in a culture that's infected with greed. All around us, there are greedy people. The bottom line is, be careful that you don't be infected.